From an early age, we're all immersed in sport. For some, it fails to ignite a spark inside us. But for those of us who catch the fire, it's the beginning of a lifelong journey filled with highs and lows, which all matter far more than they should. After all, it's just a game, we're told. Sport is a certainty. It's a point of reference in an increasingly uncertain world. And the bonds formed with either sport in general or a hometown club transcend both time and generations. Today, much of what sport has always meant to true fans has been somehow lost in a blizzard of corporate communications, fireworks, and froth. The attachments that were once so strong seem more trivial in the global age of televised sport as entertainment. What was once authentic has become increasingly staged. In this podcast, we'll get back to the things that sport has always meant to true fans. We'll take you from the boardroom, to the dressing room, to the pitch, but we'll do it not as a corporate communication, but as true fans of sport, and we'll do it with authenticity. We'll be honest, and we'll speak our minds. This is a podcast for true sports fans, and the one thing all fans have in common is a passion for the game. Now, we certainly don't mean to cause any offence, so if you find yourself taking any, just shrug it off and get back in the game, because this is about the game, and the game is bigger than all of us. Welcome, everybody, to the first Are You Not Entertained of a brand new decade. Joining me, as always, from, I presume, the lake, Roger Mitchell. Roger, there?
Yes, I am. I'm in Como, starting the new year in Como, and hopefully it will be an excellent one. How are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing very, very well indeed. Very, very well indeed. Lots of festive sport to talk about, and I figured that, seeing as the first podcast of the year, I figured we could take a little look back at 2019 and look forward to 2020. What do you say?
I think that's good. You know, there's been a lot of these articles about, you know, roundups and predictions for the next year, the next decade. But I'm sure you and I can come up with, as usual, as is our wont, a slightly different slant. Hopefully, well, anyway.
I suspect so. Now, I mean, I don't know how you want to do this, but I was figuring we could just throw a couple of sports out there and pick some moments in the year that caught our eye. What do you think?
Okay, let's see how that goes.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'll let you have first pick of sport.
Oh, okay. Well, let's start with the main one, the main sport, my sport,
cricket.
Football.
Oh,
football. Okay. And I was thinking, you know, I saw the Man United recent results, and I was thinking, you know, what the hell has happened to these clubs? You know, Man United, Arsenal, let's throw in Milan, that have... gone global corporate, big finance over the last decade, and, you know, try and rationalize why they've gone from being, you know, top teams, top contenders, to being teams that struggle to get into top sixes these days. And, you know, I've mentioned this in the past over the weeks, you know, the thinking is that the Americans and the new investors don't understand football. And I was thinking, well, you know, maybe that's not true, because if you look at Liverpool, you know, they've yeah, done the opposite, you know. So what is the real reason? Because it's quite dramatic. If you look at the lineups of Man United, Arsenal and AC Milan these days to where they were 10 years ago, it really would make your eyes cry. You know, the difference in the quality of the player is astonishing.
Well, look, I mean, I think if you take Liverpool and United and you want to talk about the owners, to me, it's very, very clear. You've got John Henry at Liverpool, who has overseen the sort of triumphant resurgence of the Boston Red Sox from a storied franchise that hadn't won a Major League World Series in 100-odd years to a powerhouse again. So he's used to winning. He knows what it takes to win at the elite level. And that group were all about winning, and they saw what a successful team did in terms of merchandising rights, in terms of, you know, ticket sales, all that good stuff. Whereas in the Glazers, you know, United have got people who aren't used to that kind of success. And to them, it's more of a corporate transaction Rod. So I think it's simple. It comes down to having genuine sports-loving owners versus, or at least sports-loving owners that prioritise the team and understand the importance of having a successful team over owners who lucked into a successful team when they first bought United and had that era where everything was great, and so it kind of papered over the cracks. And then once it gets time to actually start paying up and getting good managers and being football people, they are sorely wanting.
Yeah, and as I say, I think that is my first derivation of the answer. But maybe it's another one. Maybe it's just simply when you get your hands on a top, top manager coach that is able to command and take control of a club. I mean, can you remember Man United and Arsenal before Ferguson and Wenger? They weren't that great, were they?
No, look, they weren't. But when those two took the helms of those two teams, the player power wasn't anywhere near like it the way it is now, Rog. I mean, that's the big problem is that those two took the reins when the manager was important, right? And wasn't replaceable if the players didn't like him.
Well, okay, but you know what I was going to continue with there is saying, is it not maybe the answer with Liverpool, not so much John Henry, which, by the way, I take your point, you know, and anybody who likes the film Moneyball will recognise John Henry's vision for sport in general. But what I'm saying is it maybe not Klopp that's the reason that Liverpool is the outlier here?
I don't disagree. I think Klopp is a phenomenal manager. I think he's done an extraordinary job with Liverpool. But the direction comes from the top down. You know, if the owners aren't right, it doesn't matter. If Klopp was at United, for example, I suspect he'd have an entirely different framework around him, an entirely different structure above him, and it might not be as conducive to him repeating the kind of success he's had at Liverpool. I don't know, and there's no counterfactual to this. But I can't help but think of my experience in business, and you do see that success starts at the top and works its way down. You inculcate a culture into an organisation.
Yeah, that's true.
And you try and build something around that culture. Without the culture, you've got nothing. Liverpool have an incredible history, an incredible culture around the club and the city. And they were dying for this kind of success for 30-odd years, right? So let's not forget what a part that plays into it, whereas United got spoiled by the same 30 years of winning trophy after trophy. But I just don't think... I think you need both. I think you need the right owner and the right coach.
Probably. I'll be interested to see what Arteta does now at Arsenal. You can already see his fingerprints on that last game. But I take your point. My main thing looking back on 2019, I guess, would be under the heading how the mighty have really, really fallen. And it's dramatic, Grant.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't disagree with that, Rog. I absolutely wouldn't disagree with that. But for the mighty falling in terms of United and Arsenal, I mean, to see a resurgent Liverpool, which, you know, will upset a lot of people. But for me, you know, I remember the Liverpool team of the late 70s and the 80s as just magnificent to watch. You know, and so for me, as a neutral, I'm delighted that they are.
Me too.
They're back where they are, and particularly playing proper this club. Kind of football, because they're a proper club with a proper history and a proper, if somewhat annoying, fan base. But they're playing great football, and as a neutral, what better than to watch, you know, Mane, Firmino, and Salah tear teams apart, and the likes of Robertson and Alexander Arnold. I mean, they're just a fabulous team to watch.
Yeah. Well, so that would be my football reflection on 2019.
Well,
there's many others, of course.
Yeah, look, there are a couple that stood out for me. And actually, you know, Liverpool going a calendar year unbeaten was one of them for sure, which I think is tremendous, given the fact that they have won these trophies during that time as well. Won three trophies. It's not just a whole bunch of draws and nothing to show for it. But I think, you know, I think for me, there's two things. One, Lionel Messi. You know, we are surely approaching the twilight of his career, and he's going to be gone at some point. So, you know, an appreciation of his performances in the last year. I mean, you know, the highlights at the Ballon d'Or Awards. I mean, he is a freak of nature. He really is. And when he's gone, the stage is going to be very, very dark for a while, I suspect. So I just wanted to offer some appreciation for really a once in a lifetime talent. And for me, I think you and I disagree on this about him and Ronaldo. I would rather have Messi in my team than Ronaldo.
Oh no, me too, 100%.
Okay, I had a feeling that you were a Ronaldo over Messi.
No, I'm maybe a Maradona guy over Messi, but in terms of the two going head to head in the same era, I think I'm, you know, to remember the famous phrase of Arsene Wenger, who's the best player? Lionel Messi, Lionel Messi, Lionel Messi.
Yeah, yeah. No, okay.
There's no arguing with that. I, however, don't necessarily agree with you that it's going to be a desert once he and Cristiano retire. I think there are some very, very special talents coming around. But yeah, Lionel Messi.
I think there's some talent, but yeah, I mean, Messi is just in a different league. I mean, he really is just an extraordinary player. And I say around that Ballon d'Or, I was looking at some of the old YouTube clips. You know, the goal he scored that was essentially a carbon copy of Maradona's goal against England.
Yeah,
I mean, it is extraordinary to watch again all these years later. And you don't see that. You know, you see the Maradona goal time after time after time. But you don't tend to see Messi's carbon copy. Who would have thought we'd seen something almost exactly the same?
Well, there is all the context of what game it was in.
Well, look,
this is where I always come back.
Some would say England were easier opponents, though, Rog, than Getafe you saw it against?
Yeah, but quarterfinal of a World Cup that you then go on to win. That's where I have an issue with all of the Messi fans, including my own son, who won't have this argument. I think Diego... especially when we've seen that documentary now about what he was having to put up with in Naples in those years, how he had the strength of character to drag that team Naples to their first ever titles and win that World Cup. That puts him above Messi for me. Technically, I think Messi is head and shoulders above anybody else. You just need to see some of the footage in training against those, you know, in Barcelona players.
It's
extraordinary. But, you know, in terms of achievement, I think the force of character and the will to win of Diego is superior, Grant.
All right. Well, that's fair enough. Well, the other thing I wanted to talk about in terms of football is VAR. You know, I think this is a conversation that has to be had.
More's to be said about it?
I tell you what, I had high hopes of VAR after watching the World Cup and seeing VAR being used to award penalties for some of the stuff that was going on in the penalty box, you know, that kind of stuff. I thought, you know what? This is actually going to be a good thing because it's only going to take you losing a couple of penalties to stop all that nonsense going on, and we might get some genuine football played in the penalty area. But this offside thing is just utter nonsense. I mean, I read this week that they're going to try and soften this, which I think they have to do. Because, you know, giving offside because your armpit is in front of the line is just beyond ludicrous to me. I don't know how they soften it. But I think they need to find a way to make VAR work in football. I really do. You know, you and I have talked about how good this TMO is in rugby and cricket. Football needs to find a way to make it work. And I hope they do because I think the technology can do a lot for the game. I will miss the arguments about whether someone was offside or not. I totally get that argument from the purists. But I think they have to find a way to make this work.
And I think, you know, rather than backing away from it, I think FIFA are intending to double down. You may have seen that they're starting to have some tensions with the Premier League now about the protocols and everything like that. You know, I'm pretty close to, you know, some of the innovation guys in FIFA. And, you know, they are trying to take the whole calling of offside away from the human completely and put it into algorithms and automatic production and all that area there. You know, in terms of VAR in general, I had seen this 2 years earlier in Italy. And, you know, what happened in England this year had happened 2 years ago. So I didn't have a lot of hopes, but... in some ways, they've not dealt with it in the way I expected in England. You know, I think it could have been introduced better. The protocols could have been clearer and they've got themselves into a horrible mess. And, you know, I don't really, really, really like talking about it because it is destroying the game. You know, this season could go down as the VAR season, and nobody will remember what Liverpool ends up doing. You know, and it's not great.
Well, look, we'll see. I suspect people will remember this Liverpool team for a long time, long after VAR has kind of been ironed out. But I do hope they get it right. I mean, I really do. I mean, they've either got to get it right or get rid of it altogether, because at the moment it's just the whole thing's a farce, which is such a shame.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, all right. I'm going to switch to golf. A goal and an own goal, which for me are very straightforward this year. The goal being Tiger Woods winning the Masters.
Of course. Yeah.
And the own goal being Patrick Reed. What were you thinking? Very clear. I mean, I was fortunate enough to be at Augusta for Tiger's victory, and it was quite something. I mean, I'd seen him play a few times before, but the atmosphere was just electric. And you know, to see someone back at the peak of his powers, and for it not to be a fluke, you know, the rest of the year he's carried on playing very Tiger-esque golf, which is delightful to see. You know, he's looked like his old self. And it really gives me hope that he might actually get to Jack's number of majors, which I think would be great for the game. I mean, there are a lot of people who will hate the fact if Tiger Woods goes on to match or beat Jack Nicklaus's major haul on a personality basis. But you know, I don't think anyone, with the possible exception of Nicklaus, has changed golf the way Tiger has. And done as much for it. So, you know, I'm delighted to see him back playing the way he was this past year. And I'm really excited to see what he's got in store for 2020, if he can stay injury free.
Yeah, can't disagree with anything there. On the own goal, Patrick Reed, we've talked about that. We've talked about Mark Kuchar and you know, is a different culture coming into golf, and maybe, and John Hopkins said that, you know, it was really just a reflection of society. I tend to think more optimistically than that, that these are outliers. My own goal for golf, however, and I know you won't like this, is the fact that our boy ain't going to get into the Ryder Cup team. And, you know, at some point he's going to have to look at himself and say, what am I trying to achieve here? Do you know what I mean, Grant? We've had this conversation.
Yeah, no, look, I hear you. I hear what you're saying. I think you're making a judgment way too soon, to be honest.
You don't think he should be in the Ryder Cup team this year? As a guy of his age, at this, you know, his progression of his career, this isn't the time that he gets into the top 14 in Europe.
Well, look, we've got a long season ahead of us, Rog. We've got a long season ahead of us, so we'll have to wait and see. But you and I differ on this. I've spent a fair bit of time with Eddie and have gotten to know him, and he's a fantastic kid. His head's screwed on right, and he obviously announced at the end of the year that he was leaving his club sponsor, which is interesting. I don't think he's announced yet who he's going with, but I had a very interesting conversation with him the last time we met in the UK, talking about equipment. And I was asking him about, you know, when you see all these guys that change their clubs and, you know, go on to have all kinds of nightmares when they've changed their equipment. You know, and he said to me, look, it's the ball. He said, finding the right ball is the tricky thing. The clubs are nowhere near as important as having the right ball, I guess when you look at the Ryder Cup and they play the foursomes in the Ryder Cup, and the guys who play different types of ball do tend to struggle trying to get used to the spin rates and stuff. And you ball. You know, for us, this is just crazy stuff.
Crazy stuff.
We're not talented enough to actually understand the difference this stuff makes. But I do get the sense that this year is going to be a good one for Eddie. I think he's making some changes, and I'll have a little bet with you now, Rog, live on air, that he makes the Ryder Cup team. How about that?
Yeah,
a nice dinner.
All right, nice dinner. All right.
Well, 50 quid to charity and a nice dinner. How's that?
Fine. That
right,
sounds good.
Done.
Okay. I'm going to go next sport, if I'm allowed, to one we don't cover a lot, but we're getting to the sharp end, the NFL.
Yes.
But actually, this isn't the NFL, but it will be. I'm talking about, you probably guessed, the Heisman Trophy.
Yeah, that was on my list.
Joe Burrow. Why don't you tell people why that is on both of our lists without us consulting?
Well, look, you know, there's young kid Joe Burrow, the quarterback of LSU, Louisiana State University. romped home in the Heisman Trophy this year. I mean, he's had an extraordinary season. They've got one more game to play on the 13th, I think, which is basically the National College Championship against Clemson. And, they will be prohibitive favourites for that. And he will be, I'm sure, in the shop window. I think the Cleveland Browns have got the first pick in the draft next year. But it's, stepping away from the fact that he is an incredibly high-quality athlete, I think what caught both our eyes was his acceptance speech for the Heisman Trophy.
Yeah.
He is a kid who, again, has his head screwed on right, was tearful, was humble, thanked all the right people. You could tell that it came from the heart. His thanks to his family, to his coach. It's just wonderfully reassuring to see that kind of poise from a man of that age. It brought me in mind of that fantastic acceptance speech that Kevin Durant gave when he won the MVP. He spent half an hour basically telling every member of his team why they'd been important in helping him win this title, and talking about his mom, and he didn't spend 1 minute talking about himself. So I'm incredibly excited to see what Joe Burrow's can do in the NFL, but I'm probably more excited to see that kind of character and personality being brought into a league, which is going to shortly lose the likes of Tom Brady and Drew Brees, and I think it's a great time to have someone like this come into the league.
Yes, I would say just a couple of extra things. He talked very much about coming from a poor state, and talked specifically about Athens, and apparently the kind of like social services in Athens, food kitchens and everything like that, have multiplied since he gave that speech, because he was basically saying he was standing up there for all the poor people that he walked past every day in Athens. And then the other thing was, which is very interesting, that he thanked his coach for having bet on him after him being out for basically 3 years with injury.
Yeah.
And it just makes you wonder, how many stars and talents are lost to sport because they just get that wrong injury at the wrong time and everybody's short term and they forget about them. Whereas the coach didn't. And as the phrase that Joe used was, you still kept for me the keys to your whole program. And, hopefully I've done you proud. It was very, very emotional, Grant, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. No, it was tremendous. I mean, there's something about that. I think that it didn't just catch our imagination, Roger. I mean, it caught a lot of people's imagination. And I think it's great. Right? I mean, I think in this day and age to have humble, genuine, authentic athletes playing at the highest level is something that the world really needs.
Yep. What's next?
Here's one for you. I want you to talk about this from your perspective as someone who's been at the highest levels of a particular sport, and that is the passing, terribly sad passing of David Stern this past week, the former NBA commissioner who just did an extraordinary job in taking NBA basketball from really the backwaters of professional sports into the global powerhouse it's become. And I there's everybody from Magic Johnson and Michael Jordan to Kobe and Shaq. They've all, the tributes have been pouring in for this guy, which you can understand that how he's viewed by the athletes. But I just wanted to get your perspective on what he accomplished from a backroom perspective, because I suspect you'll have an even more acute perspective of it than perhaps anyone else.
Well, yeah. When you take a job like that, there's the external tasks and the internal tasks, and the internal ones are usually invisible to the general public. And that was Scudamore's great talent, that he kept 20 clubs more or less in the same direction. David Stern did that with the NBA owners. But more importantly, externally, he decided to create a property that had total respect for the athletic abilities and prowess and majesty of the great NBA players and the great NBA franchises, but also created the kind of content with a vision where he saw where it could go. And, if you've now got what I would call the best type of new generation content, like House of Highlights, that is basically an Instagram media for the NBA. That all you can trace all that back to David Stern, who had that vision, who understood the power of sport, the power of the celebrity, the star player, but always within the context of the team being bigger than the individual. And it's not two things I would say about, you know, don't just believe me. Every single tribute you've had these days, and not just from the big stars, but on LinkedIn and all the industry, they're all the same. You know, there's not one that says, well, you could read through it, it's a little bit lukewarm. Everybody knows what David Stern was. And the second thing that not many have mentioned is that these truly greats also always find a great successor. And Adam Silver at the NBA, I think is a worthy successor to David Stern. And it's no coincidence, you know, that old phrase, A's pick A pluses and B's pick C's and D's. Well, David was an A, and Adam Silver is certainly also an A. And it was wonderful to see all those tributes. And also very good that, you know, in some ways that if he had to choose a year to die, he chooses the year when Canada comes up with the first NBA champions in the Raptors, you know. And that's the kind of story David would have loved, I think.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. And I had the Raptors on my list of things to talk about if we got around to basketball. I mean, it's what a fantastic thing for the game. To see. Now, obviously, it's a shame that the team kind of implodes after that. But, you know, I guess in the age we live in, the building the championship team and then letting it all fall apart is kind of par for the course these days.
Yep. So, I think that's, I'm just looking at what else. Well, obviously, July the 14th, I don't think we need to say anything more than about that. You know, Wimbledon, the Cricket World Cup and Formula One with Lewis. Probably we'll never see another day as emotionally packed as that day in summer of 2019 was for those sports. And, you know, everybody that's mentioned that in the lovely video that I think Wimbledon and the cricket people put out together about how that afternoon evolved was really, really classy. And I think probably that's what we'll all truly remember about 2019, Bastille Day.
Yeah, no, it was. It was just a fantastic day for anyone who loves their sport. And I know you and I spent the day on various devices trying to watch all three at the same time. Now, what about, let's talk about darts, because we spoke about Fallon Sherrick in our last podcast of last year. Something interesting has happened since then, and that is her pulling out of the women's championship.
Did you see that?
So she's pulled out the women's championship. I saw the headline, and it was only afterwards that I went to kind of understand why. And the reason, apparently, is that the prize money for the winner has been cut from 20 grand to 8 grand because of poor ticket sales. And it just made me start thinking about perhaps a negative side to the success of someone like that in a sport that can clearly pit men against women on a pretty equal footing. Does it end up killing women's darts because people will want to go and would rather go and see two or three women playing in the men's championship with all the atmosphere and all the craziness that World Darts Championship brings every year, and they'll skip the women's? You know, will Fallon Sherrick's success have a deleterious effect on women's darts?
Well, you wouldn't expect me to reply any differently than I'm about to as a free marketeer. The market truth will out, Grant. You know, I'm somebody that's probably most known about 20 years ago for trying to get Celtic and Rangers into the Premiership and got pretty close in some ways. And the question was, well, what happens to Scottish football? Which is a similar type question that you're asking here. In fact, probably a more serious one. And I said, it will find its level. You know, what I am not in favour of in sport and never have been are these kind of like artificial boundaries of competition. Some of them are geographical, i.e. Scotland and England and not being allowed to play in different leagues. And other ones are gender. I just let the market decide. If a woman is good enough to play in a men's tournament and then it's called the international as opposed to just men and women's tournaments, great. You know, I don't like these artificial barriers that sport puts up. And at the end of the day, you know, capitalism and the market finds a way to do that. And that's why I guess I think I'm always talking about the polarization and the inevitability of the Super League and all of that, because I just know how the finances work, and it's very difficult to hold it together when you've got such disparate assets that are in your sport or in your tournament that you're marketing. So that would be my answer. I wouldn't worry about women's darts not succeeding. I would celebrate the fact that women have managed to make it a gender neutral sport. That would be my win.
But okay, so let's go back to that Celtic and Rangers into the Premier League, because you know at the time it was a big deal, and there was a lot of ink spilled, as it was back then, about the idea. Talk to us a little bit about how the genesis of the idea, what the motivation, the aims were behind it. Because you know, you and I haven't had this conversation on the podcast, so it'd be fascinating to hear the thought process.
Well, from my point of view, you know, I was in charge of a league that included Celtic and Rangers, and the rest of the top teams in Scottish football. And what I was trying to do was to do something that would end my own job and end my own league, as it were. But I just could see no reason why there was going to be any future attraction to a league where there was only two winners. Oh, and by the way, nobody has ever won it since that time. So my view was this: the current situation favours neither. Celtic and Rangers have got a straitjacket that doesn't allow them to compete where their fan base would allow them to compete with the Barcelonas and the Arsenals. And Aberdeen, Hearts and Hibs, which are glorious teams, are having to fight their way through the quicksand of having to tell new generations of fans that they'll never win anything. And I just thought that was a lose-lose. So I tried various things. The Atlantic League, which was the amalgamation of all the smaller leagues, Holland, Belgium, the Scandinavians, Greece, Turkey, into something that would rival one of the big five leagues. Again, I think probably that was right, given where you see the last 16 of the Champions League this year, only from the big five leagues. All these things were very obvious. Fact is, as I said, you know, before, sport likes to put these artificial barriers around them and call them tradition and make that the excuse for not accepting the inevitable. Celtic and Rangers were very keen on this, especially when they found somebody at the league, i.e. me, that was actually a proponent rather than somebody that was going to block them. We entered into discussions with the English and with UEFA. Celtic, especially through, you know, meetings in the boardrooms and meeting people like David Dean and all the characters at the time, felt that they had, let's call it, informal support to push ahead. Scudamore then, kind of like, as always with his great skill, saw the need to like bring this to a head one way or another, called for a club vote in the Premiership, which was to Celtic's enormous surprise and chagrin was 19-0. I believe Tottenham were in the bathroom at the time of the vote, probably politically. but it was 19-0, it wasn't 20-0, but the nil is the important thing. And the thing died there, and then I left the league shortly after, and I don't think there was any further momentum. So it was something that I thought broke what was a lose-lose for Scottish football, which I still think is there today. And those were the years of the start of the change. You know, the Atlantic League, you had the people at Risdale at Leeds realising that they were going to be the haves and the have-nots, and which side of the drawbridge were you going to be in. And everybody was playing their cards in those days. Ours were Glasgow Rangers. They overplayed their hand. They went bankrupt, as did Leeds. So, you know, those were fascinating years. And what happened since then was an acceptance that football in Europe would be dominated by the big five leagues and by the top clubs in those leagues. And the question now is whether we will take the next stage of that and just basically say, look, let's just take the cream of the big five leagues and put them into some kind of like closed circuit Super League, and we'll find a way to make it sound as if there's ventilation and promotion relegation, but really it gives the top dozen teams in Europe constant competition against each other.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, this we had the same thing in golf. I don't know if you remember back in the, early 90s, when Greg Norman was talking about a breakaway set of events on the golf tour, which would only feature the top pros. And, you know, he caught all kinds of hell from the PGA Tour at the time. And, you know, it morphed into the WGC, the World Golf Championships. I mean, and that happened actually very shortly after Norman got slapped down by Fincham, or was it Beamon back then? I can't remember who was the commissioner. But it happened very shortly after. So I'm actually surprised how long this idea in football is taking to germinate, because I think you're right. It feels like there's an era of inevitability to it. It's not something that I would want to see happen, to be honest with you. But it feels like that's the way it's going. But it seems to be going there remarkably slowly to me.
Well, there's a lot of vested interest. There's a huge amount of politics. You throw in the fights between FIFA and UEFA for power, the personalities that we knew about in the last decade, Blatter, Platini, and none of them liked each other, and it's all come out, you know, rather uglily at the end. And then, of course, the main thing is this. Somebody said it recently. The main thing, again, is the numbers, Grant. You know, you've got the teams in the English Premiership, at the top of the English Premiership, who between their own domestic television money and what they win from the Champions League is probably as good as or close enough to what they would get in a Super League. So they say, tell you what, it's not worth the hassle. Everybody else would go for it and are much more aggressive. The Juventuses, the Bayern Munichs, the Spanish, who don't like to see the English clubs get too far ahead, they would go for it. But until it becomes an easy arithmetic decision also for the English teams, I think it will remain stuck in the mud a little bit, unless Infantino at FIFA really decides to kick UEFA in the balls and basically takes some private equity money and takes the top clubs and calls it the FIFA Club International World Series or whatever it is. And he says, I've got the money for it. I dictate the calendar. You can have whatever tournaments you want after that, but good luck with it. Good luck with finding the fixtures. You know, that's the main thing that I think is going to drive it. Somebody like Infantino saying, I want control of the clubs, because today doesn't have that. FIFA don't.
No.
You know?
No, he doesn't. It's interesting. It's very interesting. Well, I've saved until last probably my biggest goal of the year, and that was the Rugby World Cup.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which to me was just spectacular in every sense. I mean, Japan is a fantastic country. Great games, great drama. Okay, England got battered in the final by the South Africans, but what a great story with Saya Khaleesi. You know, the Japanese team, it had everything. I mean, as an event, it had everything, including a typhoon, which they coped with admirably, including angry Scots. I mean, there was something in there for everybody, Roger.
Yeah, can't deny that. I can't deny that. In fact, over Christmas, one of my family, who's a South African, obviously we got chatting about it, and he's a listener of the podcast, and he said we called it very well. And you know, I still myself believe that rugby was better in the older days when they weren't as fit, but you know, I can see that as an event, that I can see as an event that it worked great. And if you allow me, I would segue that into 2020 and the Olympics that we're about to have in the same country.
Yeah.
I think that's the thing to look forward to in 2020, because it's in Japan. I think that will be wonderful. For some reason, Grant, I have got this strange memory of a Winter Olympics as a very young boy in Sapporo in Japan. And I don't know what year that is. Somebody will say whether it was 76 or 74, I don't know. But I think Japan is a great location for international events like this. And of course, it's not going to be plain sailing. You know, you've got this whole Russian stuff with the drugs, which will be the fudge of all time, I think. You've got the what I think is the most obvious shoot yourself in the foot moment for women's sport with this transgender situation that I think is going to stir up a hornet's nest, and the only losers are going to be women athletes, I think. And you know, you've got you've got everything in that summer around that event that I think will mirror what you said about what happened with the Rugby World Cup. I think it will be magnificent, and the national team of Japan I think will surprise us.
Yeah, look, I don't disagree with any of that. I mean, I think the Olympics is always a fantastic event. And I think since probably Sydney in 2000, it's kind of been taken up a notch. I think the Australians did such a magnificent job in 2000 that everyone's kind of raised their game since then. And every Olympics seems to have gotten bigger and better. I think it will be fantastic to see it in Japan. And I share your concerns about, you know, women's track and field particularly. But I think, you know, the Olympics is always, there's always something in the Olympics that marks it out from the rest. And it, look, maybe it is just the backdrop of Japan, which will be fantastic. But I would definitely put Euro 2020 up as a potential contender for the event of the year next year, just because of this whole having it all over the continent.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm interested. I don't really have a strong feeling one way or the other. You know, I remember 96 in England so vividly. It was such a fantastic time to be in the UK and to experience the event in its entirety. I mean, it was just a wonderful time to be in London. I don't know if you lose some of that by just having a few games in different countries, or it makes the whole thing a party across the whole of Europe. But I just get the sense that again is going to be another magnificent tournament.
It will be. And I think probably if we look back at it in a year's time, I think it will be seen very much as a UK and England-based tournament. I think the early stages, you know, kind of like pop-up games, if you will, that will be cool. But at the end of the day, the finals and the later stages will be in the home of football in the UK, which is good. And in terms of, well, Scotland may get there. I doubt it. I really doubt it. But in terms of England, you know, we've talked about this a little bit. You know, this year we've seen a lot of the young players come through at Chelsea, at Spurs a little bit, and obviously at Liverpool with some of Trent Alexander. I think England have got a great opportunity to be a proper team. But I'll tell you now, Grant, again, we can have another bet on this. They won't win it. And the reason they won't win it is because they still think that Harry Maguire and Pickford are proper players. And they're just not. And England's problem, British football's problem, is that they are not able to organise and recognise great defence.
Yeah, look, I don't disagree with that. I wouldn't take the other side of that, but I don't think they're ready yet. I think I'd probably take the bet for the World Cup in 3 years' time, when I think they'll be a little bit more seasoned. I think they're probably too young. And as somebody once famously said, you don't win anything with youngsters.
A Scotsman.
But look, it'll be interesting to watch them, right? It'll be interesting. I mean, they've just dominated the qualifying games in extraordinary fashion. And they're a fabulous team to watch going forward. But you're right, look, the weakness is definitely defence. It's been that way for the last...
Forever.
So the last 25
Forever.
Years. We'll see. We'll see what happens. I mean, I remember them having an Italian coach at some point, and the defence was probably shakier than it's ever been. So I'm not even sure that the answer lies in Italy, Rog.
No, it's game management. You know, British football doesn't have as a culture the idea, we're one up, we're two up, let's just put the game to sleep. No, but, you know, whenever you've got the ball, you've got to push on, you've got to get it into their box. You end up losing possession, you end up conceding goals. Other countries don't have that mentality. In the UK, and it comes from the terraces, as soon as the ball is in the possession of your players, there is an energy that comes to say, get the ball forward, try and score. And ultimately, that is British football's, in my opinion, biggest weakness.
Yeah, I can't argue with that. I can't argue that, because I've been one of the blokes on the terrace screaming at me to get the ball forward for my entire life, Rog. So
I get that.
I have to take my part in that.
But I tell you what, I mean, we've said this before, and it's a shame that he's not got game time, you know, this first half of the season. Foden is a real player. You know, he should already be playing for Man City every game. You know, David Silva's probably, so that's an error. And he should be the fulcrum of the England team, no doubt about that. And as I say, you know, there's some excellent young players, just centre back and goalie goodness. But anyway, it'll be interesting.
We'll see. Now, another one looking forward, and again, I say this with trepidation, you know, as we head into 2020, we approach another year closer to the retirement of Roger Federer, for sure. And perhaps in short order after him, Nadal, although I guess it remains to be seen how fit he is and how close he is to Federer's Grand Slam record. But, I'm really in the sort of treasure every moment mode now, of watching these guys not just play but go head to head, because I think this has been such a golden age of tennis that we've sat through in the last 20 odd years. And again, you just feel it's coming to an end. You feel that we're reaching the point where that competition between arguably three of the greatest players of all time, if not the three greatest, is going to wind down. And, I suspect Djokovic will have a few more years left in him. But, boy, I'm going to miss Federer when he stops playing tennis, Roger, I've got to say.
Yeah, and again, I'll repeat what I said a couple of times already. I think that Wimbledon, where, you know, he threw away those match points on his serve after having twice come back when I didn't think he had the strength or the vigour to do that, or the mental ability to get himself into that winning position and then throw it away. I haven't got over that. And I have absolutely got a kind of like rejection of all things tennis. You know, I have, you know, like there's some interesting young players. One of those is Italian. I should be enthused about that. But honestly, you know, I think I want to see a complete reset. I prefer they would all kind of like just leave now, the older ones. And because I felt like that was the denouement this year at Wimbledon. You know, it just really felt that if he's not going to win that one, there's no point playing anymore, because, you know, anyway, that's how I look at it.
Well, yeah, every great athlete has to have one that got away, right?
Well, he said, yeah, well, that was a big one, Grant.
Oh, no, for sure.
It was like Tom Watson at the Open, you know, like,
yeah.
They're hard to take, those ones, Grant. I find them very hard to take.
Yeah, no, I was with you every step of the way. I mean, it was brutal, but...
Brutal.
But again, as I say, it's everything that we love about sport, Rog. I mean, it's right there, right? I mean, it was an extraordinary day, and the emotions were just, and that's just us. I mean, we didn't even have to put our sneakers on and run around the court. So yeah. God only knows what it must have been like for Roger. But again, he handled it with his consummate grace. And I just feel the end is getting really close. Oh, now.
Yeah, definitely.
It's going to be devastating when he's finished.
Definitely.
All right, well, what else? Anything else that we're looking forward to in 2020?
Well, you know, off the field, I would come back a little bit to what we heard with Joe Markovsky. I think this is going to be the year where the model changes quite dramatically, and it's going to have a knock-on effect to all sports in some way or another. The idea that we're now in a over-the-top, direct-to-consumer model where you've got subscribers paying for your sport, and where the social media partners, whether it's Facebook or Twitch or TikTok or whatever, are your funnel, you know, and that way you try and balance, you know, maximizing the revenue from your core fans while growing the new generation with social media and probably also free-to-air. I think that's quite a dramatic change for sport. And DAZN's leading that. We heard that last week. And I think there's going to be some winners and losers in this new world in 2020. And certainly in the next decade, if we wind forward this tape 10 years, we won't recognize the sports industry in 10 years' time. A whole new different set of skills, a whole new different way to market the game, how the importance of players and celebrities, long form versus short form. So all of that stuff, which is all a bit industry, all a bit dry, but it all knocks down to the field. You know, you look at a sport like swimming this year that said, look, enough, we're going to try something different. We're going to see a lot more like that, whether it's British basketball or whether it's, you know, fencing, or whether it's badminton, all these sports that I think could do it differently and do it in different ways. Optimistically, I think the next year is going to be a good year for them. And the older sports that are just going through the same old motions and thinking that we'll be fine because the social media platforms will be the bidders for the rights next time around, I think they're in for a cold shower.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's definitely going to be interesting. The one thing I do worry about a little bit as a fan is, you know, we spoke to Joe about this the idea of celebrities moving into sport. You know, we talked a lot this year about KSI, well, last year rather, KSI and Logan Paul. And to me, I understand what they're doing. I think Joe and his guys have done a tremendous job in building that whole thing up. But to me, as a sports fan, I just don't want to see it. I don't want to watch two YouTube celebrities fighting each other. I just don't, as a sports fan. I mean, I get it's great business for them. I understand where they're going with it. But I just think, well, you're gonna alienate the purists.
Well, you see, we've had this conversation, Grant, and I think we need to say this. 2020 cricket and now the 100 that's coming.
Yep.
Are non-purist forms of the game that are a way to bring in the new audience to trade them up to the purist version of the game, in cricket's case, test cricket. So, you know, this is where I think sport needs to open its mind a little bit. You can't get these younger generations into our most pure and most traditional form of the sport immediately. You're going to have to take them with baby steps. And some of that will be these, you know, celebrities, short form. And hopefully, this has to be the vision for sport. Hopefully, as they mature and get older and see a different side of life, they will start saying, well, what about that test match at Headingley? You know, the sloggers that in the 2020, yeah, fair enough, but, you know, let me go and see what this test match stuff is all about. That's the playbook for sport that kind of like finds the balance between the two. Maybe that's pie in the sky, but that's what I'd like to try and believe at this moment, Grant.
Well, look, we'll see, Rog. I mean, it's the new year. It's a time to have dreams, right? It's a time to have beliefs, Rog. So I'll let you hold that dream for as long as you like. But I'll be very happy to be proved wrong. But I remain skeptical about that.
Fair enough.
Good for the sports themselves, as opposed to the business of sports. We'll see. Well, look, that just about wraps it up for the first podcast of the year, Rog. As always, a lot of fun chatting about this stuff. Now, we've got some tremendous guests coming up.
Well, we should talk about this a little bit because we ourselves are evolving. You know, we started, you and I, wondering, you know, whether we should have a guest, whether we should just do what we've decided to call Goal on Goal, which is the two of us without a guest. That's evolved into Gels coming along and being part of the big interview with the guest. You and I will continue to do go because there's a lot of people that seem to prefer that. And we're expanding to give Giles his own podcast called The Captain's Table, which will be a different tack completely, which will be taking, you know, high profile sports stars and getting a little side inside their personality in a kind of like Desert Island Discs half an hour chat about, you know, what is the kind of like things that drive them. So, you know, we've probably now got three versions of our podcast, and who knows, maybe we'll have more. Maybe we'll one day end up being a platform that invites and accepts everybody that wants to work under, you know, our brand of authentic sport, our brand of conversation. And, you know, especially if they bring an audience, you know, they can join the family. Who knows? But, you know, we're evolving as well. And I think we're trying to live, you and I, the kind of changes that sport in general is going through. And we're trying to learn the mistakes and the opportunities with this little humble show.
Well, beautifully put. I mean, I say I'm incredibly excited for the captain's table. I think people are going to love that. You know, Giles has an incredible network in the sports world, and you know, he hasn't just done business with these guys; they're friends. And I think anytime you get friends talking to each other, as opposed to you know, an athlete and a journalist, you've that barrier's down, and you just get, you'll get some fantastic conversations and some real, you know, honest insight from people about what drives them. So I'm really excited for that, and I'm excited for some of the big name guests we've got coming up on the interview as well. It's going to be another fascinating year, I think, Rog.
Yeah, very, very pleased. And thanks again to everybody that stayed with us in 2019. And I hope you continue to enjoy what we do, and tell us if you don't. You know, we're not in A-B testing type mode, but we are very flexible to the feedback we get. And it's not all consistent. There's some people, for example, that really love the fact that we let guests like John Hopkins and Ian Ritchie speak a lot and don't interrupt them. Whereas there's other people that say, well, why didn't you press them on that or the other thing? And I always come back and say, look, we're trying to replicate here the magic tavern of sports conversation, where you run into some mates and maybe a mate of a mate, and maybe they're famous, and you have a chat. And what you wouldn't do in that environment is get aggressive and pin somebody down to tell you what they think about A or B or Z. You know, you try and get them to be as interesting as possible and make them enjoy it at the same time. And I think that's what our podcast tries to do, and I hope we continue to do that.
Amen to that, Rog. Amen to that. Well, look, all that remains is for me to thank everybody listening for your support this past year. It's been great. All the emails, all the comments we've had have been incredibly useful and a lot of fun. One more reminder, just please do follow us on Twitter. You'll find us at EntertainedR, that's A-R-E, the word. And you'll also find me on Twitter, should you go hunting for me, at TTMYGH.
And you'll find myself at RPM Como, as in Lake Como.
As in the lake. Rog, what a wonderful start to the year. I'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, wonderful. Take care. Have a great year, Grant.
Cheers.